Recorded from the U.S. Capitol, you're listening to the Congressional Internet Caucus Academy's podcast.
The panelists that we put together, going down the road here, is Luke Hogg, who's the Director of Technology Policy for the Foundation for American Innovation, Amy Boss, am I pronouncing that right?
You are.
Boss, Vice President of Government Affairs at NetChoice, Asad Ramzanali, who's Director of AI and Technology Policy at the Vanderbilt Policy Accelerator, and Nathan Lemer, who is the Executive Director of Build American AI. So, well, let's get going. We did a tech policy preview for the first session about a year ago. And so that panel was a little bit different. Amy was there. A lot of predictions, a lot of skepticism, a lot of things happened, but some things that weren't on our bingo card. For instance, one thing that wasn't on our bingo card was the Take It Down Act, right? Didn't see that one coming. I don't even think it was mentioned.
Yeah.
And that thing went through Congress like, you know, hot knife through butter. Sometimes legislation takes years and years and years to build up and pass, and sometimes it just goes through like a rocket ship. And then people that say, well, Congress never does anything, yeah, you could blink and you could miss it, right? So that's kind of a lesson, but I'd start by asking the entire panel from last year, kind of, what did you think, what carried over from last year that you think might, you know, maybe be an issue this year, and, you know, just anybody can respond, and what carried over, what's left done, undone?
I think this is on. Okay, can you hear me okay? I can kick things off, and maybe it makes sense for me just to level set just a little bit. We're entering the second session of the 119th Congress, and it's important to kind of take a step back maybe a little bit and look at where we are at in the tech policy moment. And I think on one hand, we are experiencing a tremendous amount of innovation. Technology is evolving probably faster than it ever has evolved. ChatGPT, I feel like, was a novelty 18, 20 months ago, and now I think a lot of folks would consider it a necessity. But it's also a really important moment. We're in a moment of legislative hyperactivity. A ton of bills have been introduced both at the state level and the federal level. I would argue some are productive, some not as much. I think to your question, Tim, the big carryover from last year is kid safety online. There are varying proposals in the Senate and in the House, the Kids Online Safety Act being the main proposal. That is an ongoing discussion, and I think you're going to see some action in the House on a package of proposals in the very near future here. It's an issue that has gotten a lot of attention, is constantly in the news. States are acting, and I think a lot of people are looking, you know, what's the federal government's role? Will they act as well?
I mean, I would jump on that too, which is that, by the way, thank you all for being patient with me being late. I apologize. The traffic from where I was coming was ridiculous, and I had to go through some red lights. We'll see if I get any bills later. I think carrying on what Amy said is the kid safety part is something that clearly there's interest in, and we saw that with the Take It Down Act that you mentioned last year. It's clearly an emphasis of members of Congress, both the House, Republicans and Democrats, House and Senate, that like there needs to be something done to protect kids online. But I think also it's worth noting that a lot of the proposals that are being discussed also apply to AI too, which is also a concern for a lot of people. And so it's like there is a holistic approach here that could create an opportunity for adding, I think, long-term stability into the marketplace so that you can have a situation where you're protecting kids, but you're also creating a market that allows us to have the rules of the road going down the road.
I'll agree with the kid safety bit. I think the place I start is in an election year especially, external forces are driving what Congress is going to put on an agenda. We'll see a bunch of bills introduced, but what gets momentum, what moves, I think will be driven by, in part, we're seeing a bunch of parents and a bunch of teens and girls online who are getting abused, and that's driving the political conversation of kids online safety. So I see it as kind of like a what reaches the political pressure point that Congress feels a need to continue to act. The other things that in some ways the conversations were happening, but to your original question of like what continues, I think the like competition and antitrust legislation proposals, there was a lot of conversations, but we didn't see them quite reintroduced or like a huge push on them. I could see a push. Now I have no idea where the vehicle lands or what that looks like, but I could see some push in that direction. The other couple things I'll say is, and Luke, you mentioned this the other day too, but the service transportation reauthorization, not sure what attaches to that, what doesn't. There's a few telecom provisions that I've been working on, like Dig One's proposals that could attach there, but those feel minor relative to what could be. And so there's a lot happening. The two other pressures that I think could exist in an election year, one, the bubbling of the state activity. We'll see what the state sessions lead to and what gets signed into law and what all that looks like for, you know, I think there's a number of pressures that could work in that direction. And the other one is, I don't know what the financial pressures on these companies will look like yet, but we're starting to see the, pardon the pun, the bubbling of the conversation of, is there a bubble? And that, I don't know what it means yet, but it probably means something. It's probably not a, like, it has no effect, and it probably adds a few things to the agenda that will be hard to gauge at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I would generally agree with all of that. You know, I think kids online safety is the obvious one. You know, we had 19 bills that were considered by House ENC. The Senate is also considering bills and has proposed bills. How that package ends up coming together is a big question mark. You know, there's bills in there that we support, there's bills in there that we don't support. That's the obvious one. I think competition, again, as Asad said, is kind of a dark horse, it's a sleeper horse this session. I think we have cases that are still going through the courts. Obviously, we got the Google search decision, which Google just appealed a few weeks ago, I think, right? On the remedies, we have the Google ad tech case coming up. You know, Meta's case is being appealed. There's a bunch of litigation that's going on in this space, and so I think that's you know, it's a continuing conversation that goes back multiple Congresses. It's not even just last session of the 119th, but we're going to continue seeing that. I think the things that I think I see coming ahead that are perhaps not so apparent. Definitely on the surface transportation reauthorization, it's going to happen. What's included in there? What can it be a vehicle for? Pardon the pun. You know, I think there's a lot of conversations around automated vehicles that we're starting to have, that states and cities are starting to have. You know, I think there's we're starting to see agentic artificial intelligence come to the fore. These are conversations that were starting to happen last session that are, you know, we just saw. Two big startups release agentic systems, like within the past week. So those are two big things, and then I'll save my quantum spiel for later. But those are some of the really apparent obvious ones, and then some of that I think are less apparent.
So let's talk a little bit about somebody had mentioned preemption, right? So one of the big fights last Congress or last session of Congress was preemption. You know, should Congress preempt state legislation, whether it be in AI or in the long tortured privacy legislation that Congress has been working on for at least 10 or 15 years. Preemption seems to be the sticking point. Last year, there was a dramatic amendment to not preempt the states. Can you guys explain kind of the tension there and how does that play into some of the different issues, whether it be kid safety, privacy, or other issues?
Yes, you're going to see increased tension, I think, between state and the federal government. This played out late last year. There was an amendment essentially to place a temporary moratorium on new burdensome AI state laws that went pretty far, didn't quite get across the finish line, and instead we saw an executive order issued by President Trump. Trying to do what Congress could not get done, and that is it would allow DOJ to sue states that did pass laws that were overly burdensome, and there's provisions tying BEAD funding into that as well. So I think this is going to continue to be an issue. Yes, as you mentioned, not only in AI, but we're seeing some of those fights play out in some of the kids' bills as well. And there aren't clear party lines on this. You know, you hear the states' rights issue on AI, and I think it's important to note that there is precedence for the federal government, including preemption. There's a long list of laws that are in place. But also, you know, the obvious is, do you want 50 different state laws on this, or do you need some clarity from Congress?
Go ahead.
My take on it is, you will see the conversation continue, both because I think the last one had such a political flashpoint, and it all happened quickly, right? There was discussion about it for a bit, but like over like 4 days, it went from like, is this an amendment? Is it not? Is it going to be amended? Is it going to get dropped? And to Amy's point, the partisan breakdowns were actually super interesting to follow. But I actually think it tracks in some ways to this being an election year, and that the states' rights conversation and what is the role of states. You know, we at Vanderbilt Policy Accelerator, we participated in an event at Vanderbilt that hosted a few state legislatures, and it was, if I had just given you a transcript, you would not have been able to tell who was a Republican or who was a Democrat. And in that way, there's something interesting happening there. The other thing I'll say is, I think there's also in the executive order that President Trump signed, there's some pushback that we're starting to see bubble on the BEAD non-deployment funds being used, and the state's feeling really worried about that in particular. And
in BEAD being the broadband.
Thank you for saying that. The broadband program that was signed in the last administration has, both administrations have held up in various capacities, and that money being tied to whether a state has, there's some views on what that executive order could exactly mean, but has gone far enough to kind of not have state AI laws that conflict in some ways. So all of that, I think, creates a dynamic that if the states are worried, if the executive branch has said something the states don't like, that creates an opportunity for Congress to act, but it's not clear to me that the politics align in a way that action moves, but it's probably like political, it's not gonna be pretty, right? It's gonna be a lot of like clashing on what to do.
And I would just say, to add to Asad's point on, you know, it's not going to be pretty. I think that the kind of two big lessons from the last time we had this conversation on preemption is one, like why was BEAD a part of the conversation at all? Well, BEAD was a part of the conversation because the preemption proposal was trying to go through reconciliation and had to pass the Byrd rule, right? And so it was actually very interesting to see that again pop up as part of the Trump administration's executive order. So one big question is whether or not that, you know, when we get around to legislating on this, does that remain part of the equation or not? I think that remains to be seen. I think the other big takeaway from last session was, and this is where, you know, to Asad's point, where it gets messy, is I think that it was essentially the preemption proposal was trying to preempt something with nothing. And I think that that's, you know, we can debate whether that's good or bad, but from brass tacks realpolitik, I think what we saw in the Senate was that we kind of need something. You got to have something, and whether that's rules around privacy, whether that's rules around kids' online safety, whether that's rules around, you know, you name it, it'll be interesting to see how that conversation plays out again this Congress, and kind of what is the something that we need to attach to preemption in terms of, you know, federal rules and regulations.
Yeah, that's actually the part of the executive order on AI that I found most interesting at the end of the year, was that there was actually a call for potential legislative texts or proposals from the administration to kickstart a conversation. We've also seen members of Congress, particularly, you know, talking about draft legislation. There's legislation being proposed from members here in the House. I know in the Senate there are others thinking about this too. And one thing that I've been encouraged by is I was willing to defend preemption. I'm willing to fight that battle. But to have a proactive framework in actually laying out what that looks like and what that entails, the roadmap, I think is really important. And I think that that dynamic, and we're starting to see this from not just on Capitol Hill or from the White House, but we're starting to see others outside, you know, in various think tanks and other industry organizations and others, the kind of like, you know, chattering class DC ecosystem, we're starting to see what a framework can look like. It's about like, you know, mitigating real harms. It's about like what rules of the road with transparency are good. Are there things from the states that have been proposed that might actually be good at a national frame and a national level? So like, and that's actually not a bad thing as well. Also things that are naturally bipartisan. So again, whether that gets done today or not, I don't know. I'm sure Kalshi has very interesting odds, and I'll be playing those later. But I think to the larger point, by the way, Kalshi is something we should probably talk about for this year. Anyway, but for the larger point, I do think it is interesting and encouraging to start to see what people are for. And I think that will allow us to have a conversation. Even, you know, Blackboard had a bill, a Trump AI bill. Maybe not ones that accelerationists like, but it is a bill. There are ideas out there. And I think that's going to kickstart a conversation that would be very helpful this year.
So thank you for mentioning Kalshi. The last minute I realized I should have looked up the prediction markets on what they think.
I do every day.
I should have looked it up. I'm sorry about that. But you probably can go look it up and bet on what you think, you know, will pass. And this will inform your winnings, basically. All these people are going
to
help you pick the right one.
Do we have to do like a conflict of interest statement now? Or like,
yeah. Sorry about that. Let's just before, like on kid safety, let's just look, just drill down that COSA is left over. There's a few other bills that are out there. One thing that wasn't in this conversation last year at this time was AI companions. That's popped up. Where do you see the kids online safety thing going? Does COSA, because it has some bipartisan support, become a vehicle that other things, how does that play out, do you think?
Well, I think it's really hard to tell. So, there are very clear tragedies that have happened in the past year that I think are driving part of this conversation, or especially driving these conversations in the Senate. You know, there have been children that have committed suicide because of, you know, some of these things, and I think that is a strong driving force behind you know, child safety advocates getting involved here. I also, on the other hand, do think it's worth noting and it's worth considering, you know, how do we actually bifurcate what a character chatbot is? Like, what does that actually mean? What does it look like? It's easy to point to certain, you know, certain applications like Character AI, which brands itself as a character chatbot. But one of the tensions that I think that we're going to continue to see in conversations around kids online safety, especially in areas where it's kids online safety and artificial intelligence, is this kind of two sides to the equation, right? At the same time as the Trump administration and Congress are considering legislation on artificial intelligence and kids online safety, they're also promulgating regulations and executive orders around the use of artificial intelligence in schools. So it's like we are simultaneously trying to, and I think Congress and the administration can walk and chew gum here, but it's definitely an interesting tension that will continue to play out, and especially as, you know, because it's such a general purpose technology, whether we're talking about the internet broadly or we're talking about artificial intelligence, you're always going to have these kind of tensions around positive use cases and negative use cases. And then the question then becomes, how do you bifurcate the two? And then how do you put that into policy in a way that actually makes sense? And this is, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that while we're sitting here having this conversation today, the Federal Trade Commission is having a workshop on this very question of age verification, on this question of kids online safety with regards to internet platforms and with regards to artificial intelligence. And so it'll be, you know, it's an important piece of the equation to consider how, you know, policy and legislation is one thing and then implementation is another. And so, you know, we were talking right before this about the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, right? COPPA, right? Like, the Federal Trade Commission is the one that implemented COPPA under the COPPA rule, and they recently changed the COPPA rule very significantly a year and a half ago. So how do those tensions play out both within the legislature, so who's going to be the implementer, and then how do those tensions play out once the legislation actually gets to the implementation phase.
We did get a little bit of field from COSA and child safety, but like we can get back to some of those other issues.
But I'd also point on the kids issue is, A, litigation's happening right now, which is different than with some of the social media conversations that kickstarted COSA, which is requiring companies and platforms actually kind of react differently than other platforms have had to do, which I think is actually a productive thing. There's also, again, I'm looking at the House, and it's beyond COSA. There's like 12 bills that they're considering, a lot related to like screen protection on screens, around age verifications, et cetera. And I'm curious how that plays out into this overall conversation about protecting and creating guardrails to protect kids across platforms, both AI, LLMs, and chatbots, as well as other social media platforms as well. So like, I think there's like a holistic conversation that I think is needed to have, and I think this is allowing that to take place.
And if I can quickly jump in on just the kid safety front too, I think where we are now, there are numerous court cases and a number of decisions that have landed since we last spoke last year. NetChoice leading on a lot of that litigation. And courts have been clearly consistent in that regard, that age verification schemes are unconstitutional. And I think what you're seeing, especially in the House, you're hearing from the chairman and sub-chairman of those committees, and they're saying, hey, we need to think carefully here. You're hearing them say, you know, if we pass a bill and it gets struck down, we're not protecting anyone. So, you know, there's lots of really good intentions behind a lot of this legislation, but I think lawmakers are increasingly looking at what have the courts said on these issues, and we need to respect those boundaries.
The other thing to watch here is, we talked about the Take It Down Act to start. One of the dynamics that I think moved that, or at least made everyone politically aligned to get somewhere, was I think it was north of 30 states had something that looked like a state version of a bill that dealt with deep fake nudes. Companion bots are an issue that states are starting to grapple with too. So you're starting to see the kind of what could solutions look like, some that have been held up, some that get stopped in the legislative process, some where there's going to be lawsuits. But I think seeing that kind of diversity of approach and what shakes out as a good path forward, that I don't think that takes forever, right? I think that takes like a couple months of like kind of watching what the debates look like in the states to see what's palatable.
Just worth Luke mentioned that there's an age verification workshop going on right down the street at the Federal Trade Commission with all people talking about the feasibility of age verification systems, the constitutionality of age verification systems. We have seen that those type of technologies for years and years and years. COPPA implements them to some degree, arguably. What's different since back in the day, and even since this last time we did this briefing, was the Paxton decision, the Supreme Court. Can someone just say quickly what the Paxton decision is and how does that play into what we might see on kid safety? Don't everybody jump in.
I mean, to just very briefly, right, the Paxton decision, the Supreme Court upheld a law that Texas passed requiring age verification. It's essentially requiring age verification for access to obscene material, pornography primarily. And the court essentially said that because there's this long history of obscene material being kind of this special category for First Amendment, that this law was upheld. But also interestingly, Amy might have more context here on the most recent decision, a federal court also just recently issued an injunction on a different Texas law with regards to age verification. It's an interesting dynamic that's playing out in the courts right now about where you draw that line exactly when it comes to age verification.
Yeah, I'll just add that I think it's clear. I mean, the Texas ruling was pretty narrow. We're talking about illegal content. That's very different than I think some of the other lawsuits that we are seeing in regards to age verification for lawful content. Courts have been clear, minors.
We could spend all day on kids' safety and
yes.
All that stuff. So let's try to move on.
Absolutely.
It's a bit. I think Nathan mentioned it's a midterm coming up. In case you guys missed that, it's a midterm coming up. So things get political, and affordability seems to be an issue that's being talked about a lot. And there's questions about electrical rates and rates of electricity and how much energy. Like, I can't hear any newscast without someone talking about AI and energy and data centers and energy. It doesn't help that we're like on the border of Virginia, which is like data center of the world, right? So how do the politics play out with regard to AI and data centers, and where is this going in Congress, or is this just a state issue?
I think it's largely a state and local issue. There is legislation Senator Sanders introduced to put a moratorium on data centers. I don't think that bill is going anywhere. So yes, largely a fight that is playing out locally. It's kind of, a sleeper issue that has gained traction as well, and it's playing out in some elections. I don't know to what extent. I think that from my perspective, I think there's a lot of myths about what data centers do and don't do that need to be cleared up, a lot of misunderstandings. Data centers can be built anywhere, and I think it's incumbent upon, you know, these companies to work with the local communities to make sure that they're welcome, that they're well-resourced. I don't see this federal government jumping in much other than, you know, we need the power, obviously, to run these data centers.
So I would point out that all politics is local, and like data centers is a perfect example of that. Just rethinking our entire energy grid is important because it's a holistic national interest, but it plays out locally. And you know, in the state, I went to Calvin College. Amy understands that because she's a rival Hope grad. That in our backyard, where we both went to school, like there's a huge fight where local residents who would generally be okay with a data center coming in their backyard are overreacting in many ways and taking, you know, taking action and, you know, jumping into community board meetings that they wouldn't normally be. And you have Republican governor candidates kind of misunderstanding or misarticulating the conversation. I'm talking about Tom Leonard. He knows we're friends. I can call him out on it. But like these people all over the place kind of jumping on the data center fight in a way that, you know, I think is unproductive. First, I hear multiple podcasts and blogs where they describe data centers as doesn't big tech already have enough access to our data? Do they need to build more data centers to access more of our data? And I'm like, no, that's like fundamentally not what a data center is. Like, there is a fundamental lack of understanding on a data center. And I think that's a huge part of it, is when you realize that actually a data center is a part of a larger energy ecosystem to make sure that we actually have enough energy and infrastructure to power our cell phones, to access AI, yes, to play on Coinbase, to play video games, to Netflix, all that other things play into it, to participate in the digital economy. And I think there's been a real problem where people have not communicated with industry, I think policymakers have not communicated that unless we increase the supply of our energy, we will constantly increase the demand and we will not be able to meet that. And we'll have brownouts and blackouts down the road. And so there's been this fundamental misunderstanding of that. And I think that that's a huge part of this conversation. Unless that's shared at a local level, we won't be able to kind of move past that.
All politics is local. I'll add, all politics is vibes. And the vibes aren't good.
Yeah.
And so if you start from that perspective of, Tim, we were talking about the history of tech policy and how that's evolved, and how many times do you know tech policy issues where people in rural America are showing up and picketing, right? Like, that's not a like common thing that happens. And so this is one where I would not underestimate the energy, and I actually don't know if it's a local and state issue. That is where it has been, but it is also the kind of issue that is ripe for federal action, because if you look at the water issue, in some ways, it's a like, where do you put data centers nationally? Because it's a water supply kind of regional issue. And so there's a lot of questions in my mind on like how this plays out. Telecom is a good example of where you do have regulation at the federal, state, and local level. And it's a complicated mix. And I'm not saying that's the example we should follow, but that is one where you get a mix of things. And the data center mix is hard to predict how it'll land. I'll put a plug in. It's not a paper that I wrote, but our center published by Matthew McHale and Hannah Wiseman about 9 things that state and federal policymakers can do about the energy impact, both reliability and affordability. I've put out a paper on cloud computing. So a data center is a place. Cloud computing is generally what's happening inside that place. And my thought is the monopolization of cloud computing, the competition effects actually have a role in those, in all of that. The other thing I'll say that is a little bit of a sleeper issue, we've heard a lot about the energy impacts. We're starting to see more and more discussion about the state subsidies for construction. A lot of friends in Virginia government have been telling me quietly, they won't say this publicly, that they regret the number of subsidies that they've put forth, not because they're against data centers, but because the economics haven't worked out the way they exactly kind of saw it working out. Wisconsin, there's been some fights on this. So it's an interesting thing to see tax subsidy policy at the state level come up in ways that I would not expect that wonky of an issue to play out.
And I'll be very brief here. Yes, all policies vibes. The vibes over on this side of the table are pretty good. I think the one thing that is percolating at the federal government is permitting reform, right? Like, there has been a lot of conversations around permitting reform. There's legislation, there's packages that are coming together, the Speed Act. This is kind of upstream from the energy question, because it doesn't just impact energy projects, it impacts kind of how we build everything. And it'll definitely be an interesting place to watch, and I think that there's definitely room for federal action and federal movement in this session.
Okay. So you mentioned some buzzwords that you might hear more and more in 2026. You mentioned one, which was agentic AI. There's another one called AI sovereignty. Let's talk about a little bit. So, like, a lot of times in tech policy, at least in my career, if you wanted to like say we need this because why do we need it so badly is because if we don't, China's gonna get it. So it's China. So talk a little bit about what AI sovereignty means. What does it mean for like chips policy? What does it mean for AI policy? And how do we win the race against what is always the main competitor, which is China? And how does that play into the politics up here?
I'm happy to start it. One way to think about the US AI China, the US China AI arms race, which I have some qualms with that framing and what we should actually desire, but let me put out what I think is the what's happening. Both President Trump's administration, but also President Biden's administration, viewed AI as a central pillar of geopolitical competition with China. It's we need AI for a number of reasons, including national security. That means AI's use in the military, but also the economic benefits of AI accruing to the country and building a national security, an economic security like advantage. President Trump's executive order a few months ago on this question of how do we export the AI stack, right? That framing of its chips, its data centers and cloud, it's the whole infrastructure that's required to build AI. That, I think, is a reasonable framing of where that administration is, this administration. But also, like, it's not that different from where the Biden administration was. The tactics are different, but the goals are actually not that different. My issue is, I start from, as a society, there are a lot of things technology can do, and there's a lot of things where technology is desirable, and we should, as a government, want to advance those goals. Those, to me, look actually a lot more like how is the technology used. When I hear the AI folks talk about what this could mean for weather prediction, that's a big deal. When I hear them talk about what it could mean for drug discovery, I'm excited, right? Because we all have family members who've died from or been afflicted by a disease. There's 7,000 rare diseases that affect millions of Americans and very few cures. So those are where I get excited. And those don't correlate exactly to the like arms race where we're building infrastructure more and more. So that's why I think there's a little bit of a misalignment. It's not completely imperfect, but to me, the goals as a society should be using the innovation to improve our lives, to improve welfare.
I couldn't agree more. Like, that's exactly right. Like, I was part of the 5G fast plan and rolling out next generation telecom with the FCC. We were pushing the whole race to China. It didn't sell as well as the race to like the moon back in the 60s against Russians. I've kind of grown tired of my own kind of thinking on the way I talk about China as if it's going to like rally Americans to like defeat China in AI. What they want to see, I imagine, I think, is more like, how is this benefiting my life? I think you're getting at it exactly right. I think the policies can also be helping us defeat China. That's a story that you may need to sell in these walls, in these hallways. But like for many Americans who may be skeptical or concerned or confused, especially when they read a 38-page diatribe from Dario confusing them on what AI is, like I think that's where it needs to talk about where it's actually beneficial to their lives, whether it's enabling construction and skilled tradesmen to have new jobs and opportunities, whether it's solving new diseases and new problems, whether it's creating new economic opportunity. We have economic growth in the past couple quarters. Why? Because of AI. That's awesome. But and how does that translate to the regular people, regular voters' lives is important. But you're totally right about the need for the policy-making conversations to be about what is securing us, whether it's not just the AI stack, but the tech stack in general, and how does that play out, is totally true.
I will agree in part and disagree in part, right? I think, yes, the domestic conversation is really important, but I also think we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can build and deploy and diffuse technology throughout the country domestically and still care about kind of geopolitical rivalry and great power theory. So I think kind of back to what Tim was asking, right? The trend that we're seeing internationally is around digital sovereignty. This is like a hot button term that you hear at the UN all the time, right? And it's essentially the idea that countries want to control their own tech stack. They want to control their own data centers. They want to control their own AI deployments. They want to they want to control it, right? And I think that that's a justifiable thing that countries want. Where it becomes more complicated is that when we're talking about digital technology, with a few exceptions like Ericsson, there's essentially like two places where you can acquire a lot of this technology. It's the United States and it's China. Like that's the reality. And since 2014 to 2016, China has been absolutely eating our lunch internationally with the deployment of technology through the Digital Silk Road and through the Belt and Road Initiative. I mean, if you go look at the deployment of 5G networks, if you go look at the deployment of data centers internationally, right? Like right now, 40% of data centers in Europe are Chinese owned and Chinese operated, right? And so I think the fundamental question when we're talking about geopolitical rivalry, right? There is a part of the conversation that's about who is going to have the best AI, right? This is who is going to kind of get to the next frontier fastest. That's an important conversation, but there's a second conversation about the diffusion of technology and the diffusion of kind of existing technology, and there's a lot of research that's actually coming out of just up the street at George Washington, Georgetown, American University on foreign affairs that shows that actually the diffusion of technology throughout society and throughout the economy is one of the most important things when it comes to geopolitical rivalries. And so the question is, how can we deploy technology internationally to ourselves and our allies in a way that that helps us maintain international dominance in this space? Because this is, and I think that is fundamentally where the Trump administration has focused, right? Like that's why we're talking about the exporting of the US AI stack. That's why the Department of State is operating under systems like Pax Silica, where we're trying to essentially catch up, right? Like we've been asleep at the wheel since 2016 when it comes to the deployment of technology internationally. And so, I think that is an important thing that we should care about.
Sometimes things get talked about, thank you, that was great. I'm gonna move on from China. Sometimes things get talked about for a variety of reasons. Just so happens in a couple of weeks, we have an anniversary coming up. It's been 30 years since the passage of the Telecom Act of 1996. Probably no legislative system on the Hill was born at that time, so it's not something that anybody remembers that's up here. But the Telecom Act of 1996 is a massive piece of legislation. And you'll probably hear it being talked about in a couple of different ways. One is it included this really small provision called Section 230, which was a limited liability shield for internet platforms, interactive computer services, for the content that their users post. And you might see a lot of discussion about that this year because the anniversary is coming up literally in 2 weeks, February 8th. We're not gonna have a birthday cake or anything, but the anniversary is coming up, you hear a lot about it. The other thing is that The main piece of that legislation was to overhaul and put together an entirely new communications framework for telecommunications. We talk about a lot of the stuff that we see on this device. We rarely talk about how we get stuff on this device. You know, whether it be spectrum that's going over from the house public Wi-Fi here, or the ultra broadband that's being used, cable company modems, satellite modems, whatever. And that you'll probably talk about those two things in the context of the 30th anniversary. Nathan, from a communication, will we see anything about people talking about, maybe it's time to update the Telecom Act of 1996 when it comes to telecom and how we get better internet and broadband?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to note about what happened in 1996 is that legislation, particularly around telecom, allowed the United States to take the lead when it comes to basically set the standards, kind of, you know, basically pioneer the app economy and the digital economy, was because of the rules in the road that allowed the proliferation of high-speed internet access around the country. I think there's a lot of good there. One of the things that I pay attention to in that conversation on communications is, yes, it's so important to think about, you know, the billions of dollars investment in license and license spectrum and all that, but the bigger part of it for me is actually telling the story of those men and women who are on the front lines of that deployment. I spend a lot of my time talking with and engaging in those projects with people who are actually building our networks, and there's so much, I wouldn't say the Communications Act specifically, but there's a lot of like red tape and regulations when it comes to permitting. You mentioned Dig Once and other hindrances to the ability of those people to deploy, to build. And so I think one of the things that I would like to see going forward in the communications conversation is, what are we doing to enable those, whether it's in AI, whether it's in energy, whether it's telecom, to be able to like be on the front lines and to build out the networks. I've tried to drag Luke. Have you done that? You did the Klein, didn't you? The Klein? Yeah. Like I bring Hill staffers to Klein Towers to learn what it's like to actually build the infrastructure. It's incredible what those men and women are doing. When you climb up 1,500 feet in the air, Luke didn't, he did like 100. But like if you take 1,500 feet in the air, 2,000 feet in the air, like those men and women are out there all year round. In this sleet, in this snow that we had last week, they'll be out there in the summer. And like, what are we doing, not just thinking about the long-term, larger kind of macroeconomics of it, but also, what are the rules of the road to ensure that those people are able to actually build and deploy? What are we doing on the workforce training side? What are we doing on that? So like, I'm not interested in like rewriting the Comms Act right now, especially on telecom. I like what Brendan Carr is doing. Keep it up, my man. But like, what I'd like to see is a more concerted effort to talk about how this fits into the overall reindustrialization of our country.
So a lot of the people that are here in person trudge through tremendous obstacles to get here, so I feel obligated to have the audience ask some questions, because thank you for showing up on a crazy day. So we'll go to the audience for a question or two. If you have one, great, in a second. But in the meantime, just ask. Luke, you mentioned agentic AI. And we talked about must-pass legislation. You mentioned the Surface Transportation Act. Can you just quickly say, what does that buzz term mean, agentic AI? I think of it as, and you can correct me, I think of it as like, we're in this really amazing period where machines are doing things for us, and they're making decisions, and they're actuating things on their own, kind of at our direction, but they're acting on their own. One of the big ones being, in my view, is self-driving autonomous vehicles. I mean, I can look out the window and see a Waymo driving by right now. And actually, I can't, but I don't know what they're doing in the snow, but that's a different question. What happens when these agents inadvertently harm somebody or create a tort? What is the liability scheme there? And I'm not quite sure. That's how I see agentic. Is that right? Or did I get that right?
Yeah.
And how does that play into what they're doing up here?
Yeah, I think that is, that's generally right. I mean, what is agentic AI? It's literally having an agent. Like, that's where you get the term agentic, right? It is having, it is letting AI do something for you in a way that you know, that you wouldn't do it. It's kind of like, you kind of think about it like having a secretary, right? Like your secretary can read your emails, understands you, understands that maybe you don't like 9 o'clock meetings in the morning because you're not a morning person, and can help you schedule and do things. It's essentially just a way that AI can help you do things that normally you would have to do for yourself. To your question though, I think that is the question of liability, the question of responsibility is one that is massive, and I don't think that we fully understand some of these implications, right? Once agents start being able to make financial transactions for us, once we have agents that are able to, you know, talk to your doctor and schedule meetings, we already have agents in the form of, you know, automated vehicles. And I think in automated vehicles, we have better liability schemes than we do in some other circumstances. So if we're looking at things to watch from a policy perspective over the next 4 to 5 years, I think agentic AI is going to be a huge question, because just how when the internet came along, we had to figure out intermediary liability. You just talked about Section 230. We had to figure that out, right? Like it didn't naturally fit. We had to figure it out, and we got Section 230. We're going to have that point again, but with artificial intelligence.
And we also got the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is also intermediary liability.
Boo.
Go ahead.
I was going to, can I bring the last two questions together a little bit?
Yeah, do whatever you
want. So the 96 Act, which has a lot of good and a lot of things that I think we may have done differently if we had known, but you never have hindsight, was based in large part on competition policy. The idea being, how do you create, which is really hard in legislation, how do you create the circumstances for companies to have healthy market competition within and across categories? The thing that agentic AI strikes to me is that's a really nascent area. One of the areas that's caught a lot of attention is coding agents, right? This vibe coding space. Has anyone here tried that? Have you guys played with vibe coding at all? Okay, just the nerds up here. One of the things I think about is when you think about AI as a technological stack, the different parts of the stack, how healthy each layer is, influences the innovation that happens on top of it. So the AI coding agents, where we've seen some independent companies, some startups doing interesting things, they're dependent on the health of the foundation model market. They all depend on basically one of three, with some caveats, foundation model providers. We're starting to see some anti-competitive behavior there in ways that we've seen in telecom, in ways that we've seen in other places. My concern there is not should we bring an antitrust case or whatever. My concern is that's actually going to have an impact on the development of the agentic market if Anthropic, OpenAI, and Google start to preference their own products and not let startups compete. Right, so that's where I get a little bit worried, and I have a paper coming out tomorrow on this exact topic, so you guys should all go read it.
You should have put it out today. You should have debuted it here.
I wish I had publishing controls.
Well, okay, so I'm going to go to the audience for just a question or two, but Asad also raises a question about, you know, coding, and if you're a software engineer coming out of college, you're like, well, what is my future going to be? Up here, the future of work, computer science and coding careers are kind of the canary in the coal mine of how AI is affecting the labor market and work. What happens up here on that? But there's, you know, Asad talked earlier about vibes. I think when it comes to AI and work and members of Congress, that's more angst is the big thing. So there's going to be a lot of angst about that. But let me go to somebody had their hand up in the back.
Thank you.
I'm happy to jump in. I don't think we will see a bubble burst this year. I do think there is an exuberance in the market that at like the highest level, the math is hard because there are trillions of dollars of investment commitments that are chasing currently tens of billions of dollars of revenue. Now, the potential, the promise, is that that shifts, right? That is a hockey stick graph, that at some point those revenue shifts. The worrying signs for me are the type of asset classes that are involved. And I'm sorry to get wonky for a second. I started my career in finance. We went from cash deals and equity deals to bonds, corporate bonds, to private debt and special purpose vehicles in ways that I actually think we don't have a full accounting of what's going on. I think it's actually pretty hard to like sum up the numbers and understand how much debt is where. So I don't think it's like a red alarm, like there's a bubble bursting tomorrow, please everyone get ready. But I think it is there's something happening. Everyone pay attention, right? Let's not get caught off guard. That's kind of where my mind is.
I'm not one of the experts in the panel. I'm just the dumb moderator. But can I jump in a little bit? When you're talking about a bubble, you're talking about a financial bubble. And not to be confused with a bubble like AI isn't really a thing. Like, I think everybody agrees that AI is a thing.
The financial bubble is agnostic of the power of the technology.
Exactly.
Right? Like, that is AI may or may not be a thing. I think they could, like, those two questions could influence each other in ways, right? Yep. Like, the more powerful AI seems, the more money pours in, the more. But, like, I think those are happening on different tracks.
Yes. The reason I say that is because in the dot-com crash in, like, the early 2000s, internet policy was very nascent, and the Congressional Internet Caucus was up here saying, the internet's really important. And members of Congress are like, no, it's not. It's like a bunch of geeks in front of their laptops. And people were saying, no, it's going to be really important. And when the dot-com crash happened, a lot of members were on record as saying, I told you it was just a joke. And the reality was that it was a financial crash, but everything just kept going up with regard to internet innovation.
So, well, one other thing, I don't know if you were talking about financial bubble, but I think you also hit at something that I thought was, I think, beyond that I think is actually really essential to discuss, which is that for a lot of people, they don't see the benefits, or they don't understand how it can transform their lives in positive ways. Or they don't feel that they have the literacy to participate with these apps or leverage them in ways beyond AI slop on X. I don't know if that's what you're getting at, but to me, like, one of the things that I find so important what you're getting at is there needs to be, I think, an effort, I don't know, public-private partnership or what, to treat AI like we treated the build-out of electricity 100 years ago, to explain to people in the 1920s to raise education awareness of how they can leverage electricity for their own benefit. In West Texas, it was seen as like the demons coming in from the outside with the wires of electricity. My Amish neighbors in Pennsylvania feel the same way now. How do we communicate that message through education? How do you create the next workforce so they can leverage that? That, I think, is a really important point, in that every year that we're pushing that can down the road and not enabling kind of more voters and more consumers to be part of that conversation, the harder it is to sell that it's going to be a benefit to them. I know you have some other questions, but I hope I'm happy to talk more later.
Well, we're kind of running out of time, so let me just kind of...
He had a question back there.
Real quick.
Yeah, this might be kind of a long question, but you brought up Section 230 a little bit, and I know we spent a lot of time in this discussion talking about child safety, and there's a lot of questions around reforming that law or sunsetting it to make social media companies liable for what's on the platforms. So I'd like to hear from all of you, some of you, about what you think about the law, if it should be reformed. If you expect to see anything happen, I know Senators Graham and Durbin have a bill in the Senate about sunsetting it, so.
I don't see a repeal or sunset happening. You may see more smaller targeted reforms, but I mean, there's an argument to be made that Section 230 is more important than ever. There's more user-generated content than ever before, and I think, you know, without it, what you would see on the internet would look very, very different. So, you know, I see Section 230, that debate heating up. It often pops up, you know, from both Republicans and Democrats. Republicans upset over censorship, Democrats upset over content not being taken down. I don't see them coming to an agreement and saying, hey, we need to repeal and sunset. I don't know if others agree.
One of the point on that, I've always wrestled with this too, because I've had criticism of Section 230. Everyone who's read my Twitter knows that. But like, the question I always have is like, what's the alternative look like? And I don't know that anyone who is proposing that legislation has explained what the economic or the free speech impact would be, and how do you mitigate that? I think that's, I think, the challenge. So on CalSheet, I'm still like not, like I'm not advising you for the investment that it's gonna happen this year, or the repeal of Section 230 or sunset of 230, but like I think that's a big reason why. Is I don't know that they've articulated an explanation of what it would look like without it.
In the context of things we didn't see coming, like how does AI affect Section 230? Like does Section 230 apply to AI content? And that could that be a wrinkle this year we didn't see coming?
Well, that sounds like something the State of the Net will have to discuss in long-term conversation.
Panel just on that.
And there's like there's so many issues. We had to do a massive conference down the street like to cover them on, and we still don't even get all of them. Like we haven't talked about copyright and AI, which is that issue probably this year. I think if I correct me if I'm wrong, there's a lot of cases working their way through the courts, a lot of settlements, a lot of business deals happening. Once those cases start being decided, then we'll kind of understand the parameters a little bit for legislation if necessary. I think that's where we are. Is that correct, maybe?
I think that's right.
Yeah, it's so.
So in the lightning round, let me just ask you guys real quickly as we kind of finish up here. What major tech issue are we not talking about? Not necessarily what we didn't talk about here today, but just what is on the Hill? What are people just not talking about that they should be talking about, in your estimation? Real quick. And if you have no opinion, that's great.
You already brought up copyright and AI, which is a big one for us. I think the other one is quantum technology, quantum computing. The National Quantum Initiative is due for reauthorization. It will hopefully happen this session of Congress. That'll be the National Quantum Initiative Act 2. And there's a lot of excitement about that, about how we can learn from NQI-1, what we can take those lessons and how we can deploy them. And I think this is a big bipartisan or nonpartisan win-win for kind of basic science and also for the administration's goals. So,
if we pass quantum, then the crypto situation is going to get really dicey. Like, if quantum...
NIST is working on it. NIST has fixed that.
One thing I am interested in, I think is going to happen, is a discussion of the future of media. Like, the FCC broadcast rules do not make sense for the fact that, like, most Americans do not use broadcast TV. I mean, it's, like, 50-50, but, like, it's a slowing market. So I think, like, rethinking, like, is the FCC, should they be expanded to MVNOs? Should there be a different framework for that? I'm actually very curious about that. I think everyone saw where you have to like download like 16 different apps to watch football. That's not how it used to be, and a lot of people feel like it should be that way. And I think that's gonna play out as we see the more balkanization of our streaming. I think you're gonna see an urge from policymakers and Capitol Hill, but also in the regulatory agencies to rethink that, and I think that's gonna be one that's gonna be huge.
I think the privacy conversation that's ebbed and flowed in the last however many years you wanna talk about, I think the shift that we'll see is with a lot of the chatbot companies moving to advertising, there's going to be a lot of conversation around, wait, you're using what data to inform what thing? And I think you're starting to see some of that conversation also happening with the CBP and ICE arrests, and a lot of people saying, wait, what databases are used in what way? And there's a bill called the Fourth Amendment is Not for Sale Act that deals with the government purchase of that kind of data. But those conversations I see aren't super active right now, but could hit kind of a fever pitch.
Yeah, I think I'll agree on the aspect of privacy. I mean, it has been discussed on Capitol Hill for years, if not a decade. But I can see those conversations heating up. There's so many proposals actually that compromise privacy protections, especially in some of those kids' proposals. But I think you're going to see. They made so much progress last year on last Congress on privacy. I think it could heat up again.
And preemption being full circle, preemption being like the big sticking point there. Just real quick, and I don't want to get in trouble with regulators and you know predictive markets and policy. But if you had like one issue, one bill, one committee this year, what is it going to be? What do you predict? And by the way, I'll point out before you answer, the last two couple of Congresses, the issue that came out of left field, the two pieces of legislation was TikTok and Take It Down. And no one saw it, no one had those on their bingo cards.
Some of us had TikTok on our bingo cards. I'm going to take the easy route and say surface transportation reauthorization, because like it basically has to happen.
It's going
to
happen.
But yeah, but what's attached to it, right? Like. Yeah.
Satellite Act. I think you should pay attention to Congress and the Senate Commerce Committee specifically moving legislation to actually enable more LEO satellites up into space and streamline the process. I think that's going to happen.
Interestingly enough, on March 18th, we have a panel on satellite internet.
I'm going to say the Defiance Act. So another kids and online safety issue that's slightly different than takedown.
I'd probably agree with Nathan. My hesitancy, not hesitancy with you, is picking a bill, is that, yes, I mean, Congress gets so much criticism for not acting, for acting too slowly. These are really tricky issues, especially when you're talking about the internet and content on the internet. They're very complex, they're not easy to understand, and so that's where my hesitancy comes from, is lawmakers are very cautious.
No, it's because I'm a Calvin grad, and you can't agree with a Hope grad. That's what it comes down to.
Well, they are really complicated, and that's why this program exists. Like every month, we will do a briefing in this room on a different topic. Next one is satellite. We'll probably do one on video streaming. We'll probably do one when some of the cases drop on copyright and AI, and that's the purpose of this program. So keep on the list and come and join us. And thank you for illuminating. We didn't get to everything, but this is a really great overview. Thank you everybody for you sharing your expertise, and thanks for the people in the room that braved the vast tundra to get out here. Like, great job, excellent, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Cool.
Nicely done, fellas.
Yeah. And Amy.